we got a busy day ahead. We're going to hit the ground running with a very interesting story. We've talked with Uwe Simonetto many times on this program about the Islamization of Western Europe. Well, the inevitable seems to be occurring. If you've looked in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, you might have seen recently in the World section, Europe's Muslims facing rising Islamophobia, report warns. Well, the story's out of Austria and then Germany and several other countries where they are finding more and more common incidences of anti-Islamic activities on the part of the non-Muslims in Western Europe. So we'll talk about some of that with Uwe Simonetto. He saw it coming. I know he did. We'll be talking with him in just a few minutes. And for about the next 15 minutes of the program, we'll round off the first hour of Issues, Etc. today, talking with Dr. Adam Francisco about Luther, Lutheranism, and Islam long before we had our modern fascination with Islam. The 16th century reformers were thinking and writing about it. We'll see what they had to say about a religion with which they had firsthand experience, too, in the 16th century. Then, in the second hour of the program, Jennifer Roback Morse joins us. There's a new survey, this also from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, today's paper, Sex Before Marriage is U.S. Norm, study says. Norm, not exception, norm. We'll find out what Jennifer Roback Morse has to say about that. And then, in the very last hour of the program, audio open line, starting right about 4:15, 4:20, we've got a CNN story on the top 10 religion stories of 2006, an ABC report on Christianity in Iraq. Most of the Christians are fleeing from the south to the north, where they feel safe among the Kurds, and then a CNN poll on the 2008 presidential race. If the race were held today and so-and-so was running against Huzitz, how would you vote? And then they start mixing it up and the numbers change a little bit here and there. We'll play that and we'll get your reaction to it in the last hour of Issues, Etc. Audio open lines. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. We are coming to you live this Wednesday, December the 20th. That's only 5 days from Christmas, and that means a very short 5 days to think about maybe a last-minute Christmas gift for your kid or your grandkid or your godchild. It's the Issues, Etc. book of the month for December. Think about that one. It's called From Heaven Above. It's a picture book based on Luther's Christmas carol, From Heaven Above, based on Luke chapter 2, of course. The book is $14.99. Find out everything you need to know by going to our website, issuesetc.org. You'll find the book of the month there. You can also call Concordia Publishing House and ask them for the book, From Heaven Above, our Issues, Etc., book of the month for December. 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. It's the Issues, Etc., book of the month for December, From Heaven Above, A Christmas Carol by Martin Luther. Well, this was going to happen sooner or later. As the population of Muslims grow in Western Europe, a reaction is inevitable before, as some have predicted on this program and elsewhere, before the Islamic population outstrips the non-Muslim population in Western Europe, there will inevitably be these kind of reactions. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch in the World section, Europe's Muslims face rising Islamophobia, warns. This story from the Associated Press. Dr. Uwe Simonetto joins us. He's an international journalist. He's director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and the Concordia Center for Faith and Journalism. Uwe, welcome back.
Good to be back.
And Uwe is joining us from France. Uwe, have you been reading reports there? What do you think of this term Islamophobia to characterize what's being reported in the press today?
It's another nice politically correct term. Sort of nonsense that one gets. Islamophobia is a term where people attribute suddenly a phobia against another religion, which does not actually exist, except that representatives of that religion are very busy attacking other religions in Europe, which is not their habitual homeland, especially the Jews. And then the rest of the Europeans, especially here in France, where I'm at my second home, are being accused of being anti-Semites. And nobody ever says that those people who attack synagogues and rabbis and Jewish schools, etc., are not called Marcel and Fabien and Jacques, but they are called Mahmoud, and but that's not being told. So we're having a politically correct operation here.
So then, is this an inevitable outcome of what you and I have discussed many times on this program, the growing population of Muslims in Western Europe? Was this bound to happen, for good or for ill, sooner or later?
It's bound to happen, and it has to be put under control. And the only way to put it under control is, first of all, to speak to the issues, saying that Muslims that move here to Europe will have to respect European laws, which they do not. I mean, they don't. It is blatantly obvious from their sermons and their mosques that they despise Europe, and they think they are going to be ultimately victors in the culture war or the religious war, which is pretty much what they are saying. And they actually have a reason to say so, because the Europeans are not reproducing, the Muslims are reproducing at alarming rates, alarming for Europeans. You can't blame them. I mean, they do make children, and I think it's normal to make children, whereas the Europeans, especially the Spanish and the Greeks and the Germans and the Italians, are not.
Let's talk about the either failure or outright refusal of Muslims, some Muslims in Western Europe, to integrate into the culture, into the laws, and into the general fabric of society, whether it be Germany or France or Austria?
Well, by and large, most the masses of the, obviously the Muslim, upper-class Muslims or middle-class Muslims were integrating perfectly well, but the masses are not. They don't integrate, they don't learn the languages, they speak gibberish. Here in France it's called Ber, and in Germany it's some sort of strange mix between Turkish and Arabic and some German. They don't finish school, and they don't see any need to integrate in the society, because they think the society is A, infidel, and B, moribund, and C, totally perverted, and they see the evidence all around them, the gay bars, the homosexual culture, the sadomasochistic culture, the so-called love parades, the massive fornication going on all over the world, and nobody goes to church. That is the way they perceive Europe. I think they are, I hope they are going to get to this conversation. I think they might be, this might be a premature assessment of what is going on here in Europe, but it is evident that the Europeans have lost their way.
So it's really a combination of two factors, if I'm hearing you correctly. One, in some cases, the moral bankruptcy of European society in general. And then add to that a devout, or in some cases, a fanatical Islamic population that do not want to and see no point in integrating into society. Where do the Muslims tend to fall in the demographics of Western Europe, in the social strata and in the economic strata, Uwe?
Well, in the economic strata, most Muslims are in a sort of sub-proletariat. But in the economic strata as well, but demographically, of course, they're not. I mean, 40% of the population of Rotterdam, which is Europe's largest seaport, is 40%. 40% of the Rotterdam citizens are Muslims. You can go on. The most popular baby boy's name in Belgium is Mohammed. The most popular baby boy's name in Rotterdam is Mohammed. Amsterdam, Mohammed. Malim. I'm quoting Mark Stein here, who just put out this very interesting book, America Alone, which claims that that ultimately America will be the last non-Muslim country in the Western world. I have arguments with him over that, and I hope we'll be able to discuss it later. But his data are very compelling. Malmö, Sweden, Mohammed. I mean, 40%, 50% of the parents in Malmö, Sweden call their children Mohammed. This is not because the Swedes, who might call their children Lars or Uwe like me or Uwe or something, would suddenly call Mohammed. No, it's because the Swedes, like the Germans, like everybody else, are not reproducing. They are in a cultural decline, in demographic decline. The Muslims are reproducing, and so therefore most babies born, male babies, because in Islam that's the only one that counts, at least in this particular form of primitive Islam, there are presumably others, they're Muslims. So it doesn't. You don't have to be an Einstein to understand that before long this is going to be a majority tribe, and that applies to Germany and to Austria and especially to Italy. There are parts of Europe, such as Italian cities like the Italian Detroit, city of Turin, where you have Sharia courts in action that will punish people by amputation and other things for things like theft or blasphemy or God knows what. We know that from the results. Obviously, they don't sit in public. But there is another side to this whole story, which I have discovered now. I've just flown from the States into Germany, spent a couple of days in Germany, and then driven over to France, that finally the Europeans are waking up. So what is now being called Islamophobia might also be called a sudden awareness of of something we're about to lose. And then there are reactions ranging from idiotic, which might be Islamophobic, to a simple awareness that, you know, we do not wish to be a Muslim society that holds women in low regard, that decapitates people, chops people's arms off, and pours the wine in the street and doesn't allow other religions to function. And there is a lot to be said about this, especially in Germany now, and in Denmark and other countries, a radical turnaround, a sudden awareness with fascinating results.
We're discussing a new report on Islamophobia in Europe. Uwe Simonetto is our guest. He is an international journalist, director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and the Concordia Center for Faith and Journalism, and he joins us live from France this afternoon. I'm Todd Wilkin, and this is Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers as we come to you this Wednesday, the 20th of December, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We also have an in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Shortly, we'll be talking with Dr. Adam Francisco about Lutheranism and Islam. So, Uwe, I take it you believe, to some extent, the predictions of a majority status for Islam in Europe. I heard one a couple of weeks ago saying by 2050, we're looking at a majority status. If things go as they are, 2050, a majority status for Islam in Europe.
Yes, and that is the prediction that you probably read in Mark Stein's book, America Alone. It is conceivable. It's probably even likely. But the thing is that the sudden awareness of this danger, and it is a danger because if Islam's third attempt to take over Europe since the 8th century will succeed, then, of course, you know, the culture on which American culture is based and civilization is based will come to naught. I don't think it's we should really give up hope. It would be a horrible idea because too much has happened in the last 2,000 years that was quite wonderful. quite apart from the fact that as Christians we have a totally different belief system. But what I see, though, is that in places like Germany and Denmark and France and even Britain, and to some extent, churches are beginning to wake up. There's a project, the German church, the German Protestant church, is suddenly discovering that it is time to evangelize again, because, you know, all the Muslim radicals have to do is look at the so-called Christians in Europe and just laugh and say, you know, they're goners. I don't think this is happening. It will be happening in the future, because there is a concerted effort now by the churches, by individuals, and actually by the general population. If you think, for example, that in Germany, all of a sudden, according to the latest opinion poll, the minister, the Christian minister, being either pastor or priest, enjoys the second highest level of confidence or trust among the German population, second only after physicians, which is understandable. That is a radical turnaround. If you see that people in Denmark are pouring back into the churches and identifying themselves as Lutherans for the first time in God knows how much, how many decades, that the Danes are now proudly saying we are Lutherans. This is, you know, after their very unpleasant encounter with radical Islamism as a result of these cartoons. There is something going on here. Whether this translates into people then saying, well let's do, let's instead of aborting our children, actually have children and have them baptized and brought up as Christians, remains to be seen as a matter of faith. I mean, God forbid if that if it happens the other way around. I mean, then you are going to have what has happened in North Africa in the first century after Muhammad, and it's destruction of flourishing Christian civilizations all along the Mediterranean coast. I'm not so sure yet I would give up on Europe, as so many other people, especially on your side of the Atlantic, in the United States, seem to do.
Uwe Simonetta is an international journalist. He's director of the Concordia Seminary Institute on Lay Vocation and the Concordia Center for Faith and Journalism. He joined us live from France. Uwe, thank you very much. Enjoy your time there in France, and thanks for being our guest.
If I don't talk to you before then.
Yes. Well, we're going to continue with this subject of a sort, going back a little bit in history, at least to the 16th century. And joining us now is Dr. Adam Francisco for the remainder of this segment and into the next part of latter part of this hour. We're going to be talking about Lutheranism and Islam long before there were concerns about a slow encroachment of Islam into Europe as it is today. There were deep concerns about the encroachment of Islam into Europe in the 16th century and before, of course. Luther and the Lutheran Reformation, in large part, was successful because the powers that be in his day were distracted by the Islamic threat. So, what did Luther and his fellow reformers think, write about Islam? Dr. Adam Francisco, assistant professor of history at Concordia College in Bronxville, New York. He'll be making a presentation next month's symposia at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. His presentation titled Luther, Lutheranism, and Islam. Dr. Francisco, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
Very well. Did Luther believe that Christians and Muslims worship the same God?
In a word, no. Absolutely not. There's this. There's a few people have cited this passage from the large catechism in the Lutheran Confessions, where Luther is translated as having said that even though the Jews, the Turks, and others worship the one true God, and so people have interpreted that as meaning he suggests that all monotheists have some note, or they all direct their worship to this one true God. It's just that they get there, or they don't arrive there because they don't go through Christ. the translation itself is bad. There is no definite article in the German. And if you look at his writings at the time, other writings that he wrote the Large Catechism in the late 1520s, he's writing also on war against the Turk, where he very clearly identifies Allah as the devil. He says exactly that in On War Against the Turk.
Then take us back in history, if you would. First of Islam, and then Islam as it grew into what came to be known as the Ottoman Empire, as Luther and the other reformers would have known it.
Okay, you just had Dr. Zeman Meadow on, who spoke a bit about the origins of Islam. And after the Islamic Empire expanded immensely in the the European Middle Ages, it consolidated itself in the Middle East along North Africa and, of course, over into Persia. Then it started to fragment. All sorts of factions emerged. Then you have the period of the Crusades, where the fragmentation of the Crusader kingdoms in the Eastern Mediterranean, as well as the fragmentation of the Islamic kingdoms, it increases. Then there's a group, or there's a tribe, a Turkish tribe, which we call the Ottomans now, that emerged in about 1300, who were posted on the outskirts of Islamic lands up into modern-day Turkey. They were put there strategically because their leader was known to be a great, what Muslims would call a Ghazi, which is a holy warrior for Islam. And in Islamic legal tradition, every year, to keep the spirit of jihad alive in Islamic legal tradition, every year there are Muslims are to engage in these ghazwa, these raids led by a ghazi. And so in 1300, the Ottoman Turks began to do this up into Turkey, modern-day Turkey, and then by 1453 they had taken over Constantinople, and from there into the 16th century they began making their way up towards Germany. 1521, as just after Luther's excommunication, they take over Belgrade, which was a very strategic city. It sort of opened up Central Europe to the Turks. By 1529, they're all the way up to Vienna, late in 1529.
All right, let's pick it up there on the other side of the break. We're talking about Luther, Lutheranism, and Islam. Dr. Adam Francisco is our guest, assistant professor of history at Concordia College in Bronxville, New York. He's going to make a presentation at this symposia next month at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's going to be talking about Luther, Lutheranism, and Islam. When we come back, we've got a very brief history lesson there under our belt. Where did it go from there as the Ottoman Empire is breathing down the neck of Western Europe? What did the Lutheran Reformation, and Luther in particular, what did they do? What did they think about it? How did they regard Islam as a religion and the threat of Islam as an empire? We'll be talking about that on the other side of the break.
Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas, Merry Christmas.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Martin Luther wrote the Christmas Carol, From Heaven Above to Earth I Come, in 1531 for his 5-year-old son. It became a part of the Christmas Eve celebration in the Luther home. In the Luther family tradition, a man dressed as an angel would sing the opening verses, and the children would respond with the rest of the carol. You and your children and grandchildren can continue this Christmas time celebration. Our Issues Etc. book of the month for December is called From Heaven Above. It's based on this famous carol by Martin Luther. From Heaven Above is a beautifully illustrated children's book. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, and find the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for December, From Heaven Above.
The United States will soon have 300 million people, and a leading population research organization says that's a reason to celebrate.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The Population Research Institute says we should not be concerned that the United States is about to reach 300 million people. PRI President Stephen Mosher, a leading expert on population growth, says with the population of the United States expected to continue aging for decades, threatening the impending bankruptcies of Social Security and Medicare, among other crises, America needs more people. Despite the cries of overpopulation cynics, America's growing population is a sign of prosperity.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. For more about our work to mobilize and advance pro-life women in politics, visit our website at sba-list.org.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, where values thrive, and online at thrivent.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. I've got to make this quick. The end is near. Things really have to get done today. Pick up last-minute gifts. Still need something for people at the office. Get those last-minute cards out. Got to go to the grocery store and fight the crowds. Oh, terrible. And you think you've got things to do? I'm way behind, too. Be still and know that I am God. Psalm 46, verse 10. All our busyness these last days is good. It's the setup, the preparation, for flopping down the next days and doing nothing. It's the contrasts of life that raise our awareness of the things most important. Contrasts. Like the noise of our busyness these last days, doing the things we must do, contrasted to the silence of receiving the coming of God. Be silent, says Zechariah 2:13. Be silent, all flesh, before the Lord, for he has roused himself from his holy dwelling. How silently, the wondrous gift is given. So God imparts to human hearts the blessings of his heaven. No ear may hear his coming. But in the world of sin, where meek souls will receive him still, the dear Christ enters in. Be still.
This presentation of the Meyer Minute on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Thrivent Financial, online at thrivent.com. We do more than work. We work with a purpose.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking with Dr. Adam Francisco about Luther, Lutheranism, and Islam. You know, three of the top 10 religion stories for 2006 have to do with Islam. I wonder if you would have picked up the paper if there were papers in Luther's day. Probably would have been the same thing, because the Ottoman Empire, we've got up to 1529 here, and the Ottoman Empire at the gates of Vienna, we'll pick it up there in just a moment here. Dr. Adam Francisco is going to be speaking at the symposia at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, in January. Now, that's the 16th through the 19th on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary. Issues Etc. is going to be there broadcasting live, and we'd love to see you there. For more information on the symposia, you need to go to our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, and look for... Well, just scroll down a little bit and look for a link that says Join Issues Etc. as we broadcast live from the symposium. Click that link and you'll find all the information you need for this 22nd annual symposium. The general theme, Christian Identity in a Pagan World. It's January the 16th through the 19th there on their campus. The other theme is Confessional Lutheranism in the Ecumenical World. Issues ETC. .org. You can also call Concordia Theological Seminary, area code 260-452-2241, 260-452-2241. You've brought us up to the gates of Vienna. Did the Ottoman Empire ever go beyond that? Was that the terminus of their advance into Western Europe?
Yes, that's as far as they got, thankfully. There were times in the 15th century where they tried to make their way across the Mediterranean into Italy, and there was on one occasion in 1480 where they just about made their way up to Rome, except the Turkish Sultan died, and so everything sort of collapsed. But Had they have gotten Rome, who knows what would have happened.
Speak briefly about this concept that was in currency in the Ottoman Empire, and I think still is in Islam in general, that of these two realms, one of them being the Dar al-Jihad, the domain of war. What is this concept, and why is it important for understanding what was going on then?
Yes, well, in the Islamic legal tradition, the world is divided into two halves. There's the Darul Islam, which is the abode of Islam, where the majority of the population is Muslim. The rulers are Muslim. The people are ruled by Islamic law. Christians and Jews and other religions, in some cases, were allowed to coexist, but they existed as second-class citizens. From the abode of Islam, the Quran, the Hadith, and the Islamic legal tradition mandates that Islam is to expand until, as the Quran says, until Islam prevails over all other religions and by implication, legal codes.
Did Luther and the men of his time understand that conception, that this was something really built upon or really building toward European domination?
Yes, well, many of them did. Many of the peasants living in Hungary and the Central and Eastern Europe actually welcomed Ottoman rule because it sort of threw off the yoke of papal tyranny, if you will. But the Lutherans were very perceptive that this was not just a politically motivated imperialism, but rather a theocratically motivated imperialism. The Ottomans were expanding the rule of God throughout the earth. In fact, the Ottoman sultan in 1517, at the year that Luther begins his so-called revolt against the church, the Ottoman sultan took on the title of Caliph, which is the chief personage of Muslims across the world, and he's the one to call and to support and encourage Muslims to go wage jihad on the sphere of war, the sphere of jihad.
How did Luther understand Islam, and how did he understand it in particular in the context of the Ottoman Empire and what he would have called the Turk?
Well, many of his writings are very, I guess you could say, paradoxical. On one hand, he could describe the Ottoman Empire as or the rise of the Ottomans as a sign that the end times were coming. Everybody knows he saw the Pope as sort of the office of the Pope as the Antichrist. For him, the Turkish Sultan was the great beast from the East who would work or who would be in cahoots with the Pope, ushering in the end times. On other occasions, for example, right after Vienna, he writes this sermon called the Army Sermon Against the Turk. And while scholars have looked at the first part where he sort of interprets the Turkish expansion apocalyptically, the second half of the sermon is an instruction booklet for Christians where he encourages Christians living in the frontier lands that if they get stuck behind enemy lines in Ottoman territory, how they should behave and act and what they should think about as they're now subjects of Muslim rulers. And in this booklet, he shows that he knows quite a bit about Islamic law. He says that you should know that when you go into Islamic lands, you will not be allowed to have a preacher. You will not be allowed to bring your scriptures or devotional materials. Rather, you're going to have to memorize everything. And so the first thing he does is encourages Christians to know the basics of their faith. In particular, he points them to the small catechism. And he said the most important thing for them to know is, of course, the creed, in particular the second article of the creed on Jesus, the person and work of Jesus Christ.
So he saw it as altogether possible that at least some Christians would have to coexist with Muslims or even be subject to Muslim government.
Absolutely. This is the one of the most remarkable things about Luther and the most... one of his greatest contributions to Christian-Muslim interaction is he actually encourages Christians, if they get stuck behind enemy lines, to simply accept their fate, whereas all the other literature at the time, inspired by many of the Catholic polemicists, said, get out of the Ottoman Empire as soon as you can. Some even encouraged suicide for fear that if they stayed there long enough, they might find Islam attractive and convert. Luther says, stay, be a loyal subject of your Turkish ruler. And then he begins to suggest that once you gain a friendship with the Turks, perhaps just by showing that you're diligent, and also if you're able to strike up a really close friendship, perhaps you could witness to the Turk. So there's certainly a missionary impulse in Luther's writings on Islam.
Now, how much has changed? I mean, some might be tempted to say, well, Luther's context is unique to Western Europe in the 16th century. The actual organized encroachment of an empire is a unique incident in history. What we're seeing now, and we're talking with Uwe about it a few minutes ago, is a much more gradual and certainly not an organized infiltration of Western civilization. How much of what Luther thought and counseled with regard to Islam is useful today in your thinking, Dr. Francisco?
Oh, boy. Well, one of the first things Luther suggests to his readers, as he learns of the Turkish encroachment, is to begin praying that this will come to an end. And so conjoined with prayer was this exhortation to amend one's life, to throw off the yoke of papal innovation, as he called it, to reject the teachings of the Catholic Church. Now, at this point, Luther's excommunicated, and there's this sort of early Lutheran church, if you will. He says, return to the gospel. So for him, when he says improving your lives, it's not just a moral improvement, but it's a doctrinal improvement. He's encouraging everyone to begin learning the scriptures and the teachings within them again. So I think that's absolutely relevant today. He does immediately also encourage that the political structures within Europe, that they fight off the Turks, that they fight them not as a crusade. He completely rejected this notion that this was a war of Christendom against Islam. Rather, it was simply a defensive war that the Europeans had to fight because the Turks had started this war. They had to push them back. It was this war was unjust on the Turks' part, according to Luther, but on the part of Europe, this was an absolutely a just war, since this was imperialism. Other things that Luther wrote, he translated this fantastic apologetic or polemical work against Islam in 1542, which in the introduction he says, I'm translating this so that pastors and soldiers can have it in their pocket as they go off to fight the Turks, so that in case they get stuck behind enemy lines, they know how to engage a Muslim theologically. They know, not only do they know about Islam, but they know its weaknesses, and they know the points in which they could begin some sort of fruitful apologetic dialogue with the Muslims.
Dr. Adam Francisco is our guest. We're talking about Luther, Lutheranism, and Islam. He's assistant professor of history at Concordia College in Bronxville, New York. Our call-in numbers, if you have a question or a comment, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, or email us here in the studio. We're coming to you live this Wednesday, the 20th of December, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Today, the population of Muslims in the world is estimated to be somewhere around 1.3 billion. That is getting close to rivaling the Christian population in the world. Could Luther have conceived of such a head-to-head, at least in terms of population, a head-to-head between Christianity and Islam?
Yes, absolutely. In his preface to the book or the prophet Daniel in 1542-1543, he says that the world continues to go as it's going. The world is going to either go Mohammedan, that is Muslim, or it's going to go Epicurean. And interpreters of Luther have said, oh, that's just typical apocalyptic hyperbole. And it is in some respects. But if you read the historiographers of the rise of Islam, especially under the Ottomans, one in particular, a Chicago historian, says that if a alien would have landed in Central Europe in the 16th century around Luther's time, he would have thought that the world was becoming Muslim very quickly. So In a way, Luther sort of predicts this. Of course, he thought it was going to happen much sooner. Now, whether we're to interpret this this rise of Islamism or global jihad as an apocalyptic sign or not is, of course, up for debate. But certainly Luther envisioned this, this, you might say, clash of civilization.
We talked about this at the very beginning of the conversation, and it's time to kind of come back to it. The temptation of what is normally called syncretism, this idea, you described it well, the temptation to believe that among the respectable monotheists, as I call them, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, there's an affinity for one. At least they all worship the same God, it is thought so popularly. Talk about that temptation toward a syncretistic view between Christianity and Islam, and what Luther would have, or perhaps even did say, in response to that.
Yes. Well, first off, Luther, the first time he approaches Islam theologically, he acknowledges that Turks or the Muslims are monotheistic. But immediately, then he also acknowledges that in their Quran there's a high praise of Christ. But then he quickly says, do not let this fool you. While they may praise Christ as a prophet, and the Quran, in fact, says that Christ was born of a virgin, he says, do not let this fool you, because immediately after it talks about him being born of a virgin, it says that God cannot have a son. Because he has no female consort, he cannot have a son. Therefore, Christ should not be identified as the Son of God. He's in the Quran, not in any way to be seen as a divine being. He's merely human, and that's it, a prophet at most. So Luke, once you divorce Christ from a monotheistic belief system, for Luther, your monotheistic belief, for example, in Islam is more idolatrous because you're not identifying God as a triune God. You're in fact creating a different sort of God, as he would charge the Quran of doing.
So how do you think he would regard, and I think this is not only a Western thing, but it is a more particularly American thing. The reaction after September 11th was kind of twofold. One was to say, what is Islam and why didn't we know about this? And the other was to say, well, at least in its Western, more liberalized form, it seems to have a lot of affinity for Christianity. Let's, in the interest of making peace here and elsewhere, let's get together. Let's acknowledge our, I think it may be put, let's notice our, pay more attention to our similarities than to our differences. How would he react to that?
He probably would have erupted in anger. While it is true, socially speaking, and Muslims and Christians today do have some things in common. Most Muslims deplore abortion, pornography, things like this. But those are all social issues, more appropriate for the left hand or the worldly or secular kingdom. When it comes to theology or theological issues, Luther was one of the most perceptive people in his age to recognize that the Quran is not a variation of Islam, but in fact the theology of the Quran is a sort of supplants the theology of the Bible. It sort of usurps the theology of the Bible, and the Quran itself claims that it is correcting the errors of the Christians, because in the Quran it says that the Christians have corrupted their scriptures. So some Muslims have said that they've made changes within the text. Other Muslims have said that they've interpreted the Bible incorrectly. And still others say that the gospel, the original gospel, has actually been lost. Matthew, Mark, and John are just later innovations. And so Luther would say, Islam is not, sees itself, as Christianity does, as the one true religion that began back at creation. You know, Luther says that immediately after creation, especially after the fall, when the promise is given that there will be a seed who will crush crush the serpent's head, Luther says this is the beginning of the faith in Christ, the beginning of the sort of the primitive Christian church. And Muslims say, or the Quran says, that Islam began at the beginning as well. Adam was in fact the first prophet of Islam. So Islam and Christianity sort of parallel each other in this regard. But in fact, the Quran is attempting to correct what it sees as innovations in the Bible and innovations in Christian and even Jewish theology.
Now, before I let you go, I got to ask you about two quotes. One is possibly apocryphal. The other one isn't. It is often quoted, and if people know any quote from Luther regarding Islam or the Turk, the so-called wise Turk quote, that I would rather live as a subject of a wise Turk than a foolish Christian. According to your research, did Luther ever say or write this? If he did, what did he mean? If he didn't, would he have agreed with it?
Yeah, you know, I've heard this quote, and I have not found it in that form. He does suggest that it does not matter whether your ruler is a Christian or not, so long as they rule using their reason and rule justly. So I think it's Paul Althaus's Luther's Ethics where this is where he suggests this, but he doesn't give a reference to Luther's. For Luther, if he said that, he was making a point that one did not need to be a Christian to be a just and noble secular ruler. He knew very well, though, that the Turks, because they were Muslims, that there was no way on earth that they could rule using mere reason and notions of secular notions of justice. He knew that they would immediately go to the Quran and the Islamic legal tradition. So it's probably, if he did say, it's probably hyperbole to prove the point about a ruler does not need to necessarily be a Christian.
The other quote, and this is in your presentation, Islam should not be thought a matter of light importance. What's the weight of Luther's thought there?
Yeah, that's from his preface to the Quran. In about 1542, a Swiss scholar, was trying to get a Latin translation of the Quran published, and the city council at Basel was censoring it. And Luther found this absurd. He wrote a letter to the council saying, "Islam has become extremely important today. These are our newest enemies." He says, "In the past, we fought the Catholics or the Papists, the enthusiasts or the Anabaptists, the party of Michael Servetus, this sort of early anti-Trinitarian." He says, "Now the new foe is Islam," and he encourages both in this letter to the Council of Basel and his preface to the Quran that he doesn't turn people away from reading the Quran like many of his contemporaries did. Rather, he says Christians, especially pastors and teachers, need to know the religion of the Turks, and they need to know it well so they can educate the laity about it.
Then, as a matter of interpreting the history that we've only delved into very shallowly here, do you agree? We've had other guests opine on this, but do you agree that the Lutheran Reformation, at least politically, owes its success partly to the fact that the Pope and the Emperor at Luther's time were mightily distracted by the Ottoman Turk, and had they not had that distraction, they might have had more time to pay attention to the flourishing Reformation in Germany?
Yes, that's true, and the political leaders in Saxony and the Protestant lands did use the threat of Turkish expansion into Europe as a way to gain concessions from the emperor and the pope. But it is very clear that the theologians never suggested this. In fact, the Turkish sultan at one point told the ambassador for the Habsburgs, the emperor's ambassador, that he would like to meet Luther, and he brought word to Luther that the sultan would like to meet with him, and that Luther would probably find him a just ruler. And Luther quickly, even though he had gone up against the papal representatives and went up against the emperor, he quickly responded that didn't want anything to do with the Turkish sultan. He didn't want to be in cahoots with him at all.
Finally, then, with only about a minute and a half, how would you summarize the challenge of Islam from the Lutheran perspective?
Yes, this is a very important question. Islam cannot be simply seen as a religious challenge. Islam is a all-encompassing worldview. You cannot divorce its theology or its religious aspects from its political aspects. Islam, these things are joined together in Islam, whereas especially here in America, where there's a strong separation between church and state, that we tend to think we can lump this bifurcation on other religions. You just simply cannot do that with Islam. So it is important to see it as an ideology that fuels political agendas as well. And while most Muslims aren't willing to take up a sword or a gun, some aren't willing to support a jihad financially, many would certainly support an attempt to use the existing political structures to help sway or move existing governments towards the Islamic law or Islamic Sharia. In fact, they've done it in a few cases in America, small little changes to the law, but who knows where it'll end.
Is that due largely to the fact that Islam, some would say, doesn't recognize the separation of church and state, but maybe in Lutheran terms, has no concept of a right-hand and left-hand kingdom?
Yes, exactly. There is no separation between mosque and state. It's all encompassing. In fact, if you ask an Orthodox Muslim, they would say it's more important that Islam is the government. The government is Islamic rather than the people living within the government be Muslims. So that what the government is more important than the theology. So external factors and practices are more important than the faith of the people.
Dr. Adam Francisco is going to be making a presentation next month at the symposia at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. His presentation titled Luther, Lutheranism, and Islam will be there broadcasting live, by the way. We hope to see you there. Go to our website for more information, issuesetc.org. Dr. Francisco is assistant professor of history at Concordia College in Bronxville, New York. Thank you very much for your time. Looking forward to seeing you there in Fort Wayne next month.
Well, thank you. It was good talking to you.
Well, when we come back from this break, we're going to be spending some time with Jennifer Roback Morse. You might have seen it in the paper today. Sex before marriage is U.S. norm, study says. Most Americans have sex before marriage, according to a new study of surveys conducted from 1982 to 2002. That's a 20-year span of these surveys, so it's worth looking at. At least according to the summary in the paper, by age 20, the survey respondents had engaged in sexual activity to the tune of 77% by age 20, had premarital sex to the tune of 75%, and had married by the age 20, 12%. Hard to argue with numbers like that. The question is, what do they mean? What will they mean for the future? We'll get the answers to those questions with Jennifer Roback Morse of the Acton Institute on the other side of this break. She'll be with us for about 15 minutes. Then we're going to start audio open lines for your questions, your comments, and your reaction. We'll start with a story from CNN having to do with the top 10 religion stories of 2006. I mentioned before that three of them have to do with Islam. The top one, can you guess which one it is? Just think back over the last 11, 12 months, and your finger will probably land on the top news story from religion. We'll talk about it in about a half hour.
Equipping the priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.